The following presentation is not suitable for young children. Listener discretion is advised. If Stephen Sinofsky was being honest, it was getting harder and harder to maintain his sunny disposition. Sinofsky was a 35-year-old mid-level executive at Microsoft. Actually, he was the vice president of Microsoft Office, the company's popular business software. He'd overseen its development since joining the company in 1989. By 2000, MS Office was everywhere. Nearly every office and government used it. But being popular isn't the same thing as being loved. To put it bluntly, the past few years sucked. For Microsoft, and especially for Steven, the company was embroiled in an ongoing federal lawsuit, United States versus Microsoft. The Justice Department was accusing the software giant of violating antitrust laws to promote its in-house web browser, Internet Explorer, which Steven had helped to create. Microsoft had been caught ruthlessly punishing competing browsers like Netscape Navigator and operating systems like Apple and Linux. As a result, many saw Microsoft as an arrogant company that thought it was above the rules. On top of that, the year earlier, a Massachusetts computer programmer had discovered that Word and Excel were now automatically creating unique digital footprints for files, raising online privacy concerns. New York Times tech journalist John Markoff had picked up the story. A frustrated Steven had spent hours on the phone with Markoff trying to explain the issue, but the story came out anyway. The company's already bad reputation took another hit. And then there were the hackers. Since its founding in 1983, Microsoft's programs had always been vulnerable to hacking. But it wasn't until the early 1990s that it became a serious threat. And Steven's baby, Microsoft Office, was the epicenter. Hackers had learned how to exploit MS Office's code to send malware all around the world. Some of it had even reached Steven's inbox. Most recently, some guy in New Jersey created a worm just to see if he could, and it caused $80 million in damage. So when Steven's kitchen phone rang while he was getting ready to go to work on the morning of May 5th, he had a good reason to expect the worst. He picked up the phone. On the other end was a reporter.
"What can you tell me about the I love you worm?"
"Fuck, not again." "I don't know, you'll have to fill me in," Steven replied, off to a great start.
"Well, your company PR person gave me your phone number. You'd better check your email."
"Ugh, I'll call you back." Steven hung up and logged onto the internet. Like almost everyone in 2000, Steven's phone and internet used the same phone line, so he couldn't use both at the same time. The endless dial-up process seemed to take forever. Finally, Steven opened his email, and it was worse than he thought. A new computer worm named I Love You had hit Microsoft Outlook. This one made Melissa look like child's play, and it made Microsoft look even more vulnerable than ever. Steven had already been appointed the company's point person for this crisis. The email included a prepared statement for Steven to recite to reporters. He printed it off and logged off the internet. His phone immediately started ringing, and it wouldn't stop for days. Steven had just become a central figure in a malware outbreak that would infect 10% of all internet users worldwide and cause billions of dollars in damage. More than that, it demonstrated just how disruptive malware could be. On this episode, underground hacker groups, the birth of email spam, and the first worldwide computer worm pandemic. I'm Keith Korneluk, and this is Modem Mischief. You're listening to Modem Mischief. In this series, we explore the darkest reaches of the internet. We'll take you into the minds of the world's most notorious hackers and the lives affected by them. We'll also show you places you won't find on Google and what goes on down there. This is the story of the I Love You Worm. A drab concrete building stood in the suburbs of Manila, the Philippines. It used to be a warehouse and still had no flushing toilets. But in February 2000, it was a branch campus of a computer college, an unaccredited university that had popped up to train the first generation of Filipino computer engineers. Inside, a 24-year-old acne-scarred computer science student named Onel de Guzman was meeting with his thesis review board. Even the dean was there, and they didn't look happy. "Your thesis has been rejected," the dean said, handing O'Neill his paper. O'Neill skimmed his thesis. The title was Email Password Sender Trojan, which was, well, pretty much what it sounded like. Yes, O'Neill had actually submitted a paper that outlined how he would build a Trojan computer worm that could steal people's passwords. In the margins, professors had written angry notes like, "We do not produce burglars." "I'm not a burglar," O'Neill protested. "I only do this so I can use the internet." "You'll have to submit another thesis," the dean replied. "Otherwise, this will be the end of your studies." "Then, I guess it's the end of my studies." O'Neill picked up his thesis and stormed out of the room. Ethics aside, he knew his project would work, and now he wanted to prove it. O'Neill had been interested in computers since he was a boy in the Pandacan suburb of Manila. By the time he was 12, his favorite hobby was tinkering with his older sister Irene's cloned PC, where he learned the basics of computer programming. He visited computer repair shops and built his own PC from parts. He gravitated towards cyber cafes, where he observed and talked with programmers in the city's burgeoning computer scene. O'Neill came from several generations of fishermen, and he hoped computers would provide him a way to move up in the world. He dreamed of one day landing a job at a high-profile tech company like Sun Microsystems. Problem was, O'Neill needed to be online, and that was prohibitively expensive. Unlike in the US and UK, where internet users typically paid a flat monthly fee, internet users in the Philippines paid by the minute. That created a barrier to entry for O'Neill. By the time he enrolled at the computer college, O'Neill found that he wasn't alone in his frustration about the cost of the internet. He fell in with a group of like-minded students who referred to themselves as Grammarsoft, but the Philippines government referred to them as something else. Computer hackers. Depending on whom you ask, the Grammarsoft members were either low-level criminals or a band of Robin Hoods for the digital age. Through his Grammarsoft friends, O'Neill learned the basics of how to steal people's internet passwords. O'Neill and his friends frequented online chat rooms where they struck up conversations with unsuspecting strangers. While chatting, O'Neill would send his mark an image file. Unbeknownst to his mark, the file contained a Trojan horse program that would allow O'Neill to hack their computer. O'Neill wasn't some scam artist. He simply believed that the internet should be free for everyone. He was piggybacking on internet access that had already been paid for. He wasn't stealing anyone's identity or taking their money. Well, not usually. Sometimes the Grammarsoft guys would use their victims' credit card information to buy subscriptions to porn sites. I mean, hey, Robin Hood has needs too. O'Neill and his merry band of hackers were exploiting vulnerabilities that already existed within software programs. Microsoft's programs were particularly vulnerable, especially Microsoft Office. If you've ever used MS Office, you might be familiar with macros. Macros are a feature that automates text and other actions at the click of a button. They're an efficient way to complete repetitive tasks like writing a form letter. Before 2000, Microsoft set up macros to run automatically. Send someone a document with a macro, and once they open it up, that macro will do whatever it was programmed to do. And there was the vulnerability. If a computer hacker were to tweak the macro's code, it could do all sorts of damage. Microsoft first realized macros were vulnerable in 1995, when a computer worm called WM Concept, or just Concept, hit MS Office. When a user opened an infected file, Concept would generate an error message that displayed the number 1. Click the OK button, and it would go away. Concept wasn't very harmful, just annoying. But the next worm to hit MS Office would be much worse. In 1999, a New Jersey programmer named David Lee Smith created another MS Office worm and named it Melissa, apparently after a stripper he knew in Florida. Melissa was another worm embedded in a macro. When someone opened a document infected by Melissa, Melissa would spread to Microsoft Outlook, Office's email program. Then it would send emails with attachments that had an oh-so-enticing titles, like sexy.jpg or naked wife, or just, "Here's that document you requested. Don't show to anyone else."
winky face.
Melissa would email the first 50 addresses in the user's address book, jamming up servers and making it impossible to do business. Altogether, Melissa infected more than 1 million email accounts at 300 companies. In the months after O'Neill de Guzman dropped out of AMA, his computer college, he spent most of his time in his bedroom at the tenement apartment he shared with his sister Irene and her boyfriend, a 28-year-old bank employee named Ronel Ramones. There, O'Neill wrote his email password sender trojan. O'Neill's worm worked a lot like Melissa, with just two big differences. One, O'Neill's version would spread not just to the first 50 email addresses in the recipient's address book, but to all of them. Two, it lacked the regional restriction that would have kept it confined to the Philippines. Now, instead of phishing individual chat room users, O'Neill could scoop up passwords in bulk. All he needed was a way to entice people to open the attachments. O'Neill remembered the long nights chatting with hackers at cyber cafes. How so many wanted the same thing, a girlfriend or a boyfriend. O'Neill figured that people couldn't resist opening what looked like a love letter from a secret admirer. So he titled his attachment, loveletterforyou.txt. On the night of May 4, 2000, O'Neill sent his worm to an acquaintance in Singapore. Then he went out drinking with friends. O'Neill didn't know it yet, but he was about to become world famous. May 5th, 2000 was a Friday, and Elizabeth McKelney was looking forward to the weekend. She was the director of customer service for the U.S. Senate's Sergeant at Arms, a position that handles law enforcement matters, among other duties. As she was sitting at her desk, a Senate aide rushed into the office out of breath. "Don't open any emails from me. Delete them." The staffer looked freaked out. Elizabeth turned to her email box. There was an email with the title, "I love you." "I think I've been hacked," the staffer said. I'm really not in love with you." Then another email from another staffer arrived. It was also titled, "I love you." Then another identical email arrived, and then another and another. Soon her inbox was flooded with "I love yous." Elizabeth logged off, picked up the phone, dialed the IT department, and filled them in.
"I know, it's happening everywhere,"
the IT manager replied.
"We need to shut down the server."
Elizabeth knew that doing this would effectively paralyze the U.S. Senate's operations. It would also mean dealing with the irate staffers of 100 senators. "Do it," she said. Since O'Neill de Guzman had sent off his worm, it had quickly spread from Singapore to Hong Kong, where it disrupted servers belonging to investment firms, PR companies, and other corporations. From there, it traveled to Europe, and then to the United States. By the next day, "I love you" had hit governments and companies around the world. The Senate, the House, the Pentagon, the CIA, parliaments across Europe, the Ford Motor Company, AT&T, and of course, Microsoft. IT departments were forced to take their companies offline in order to quarantine themselves and stop the spreading of "I love you." It was also becoming clear that "I love you" had a nasty side effect. As it installed itself onto hard drives, it would randomly overwrite files on infected computers. Valuable documents were being destroyed. The self-replicating worm continued on. Journalism outlets were beginning to report on "I love you," or as it was sometimes called, the love bug, or the love letter virus. O'Neill first heard the news over a meal of chicken intestines with a friend. At the time, he didn't realize it was his worm that was causing the problem. He hadn't even checked the server where "I love you" was sending the stolen passwords yet. At Microsoft, they were all too aware of the situation. Customers were pissed, and the company needed to find a way to repair the breach. Steven Sinofsky and his team debated whether to disable macros from automatically running in Outlook. But macros were a popular feature. Many businesses relied on them, and severely modifying them would have made even more customers unhappy. It was possible Microsoft might even have to remove Outlook from Office entirely and thus lower the price. In the US, things were, to put it mildly, all fucked up. Private companies were aware of the "I love you" worm several hours before the US government was. The FBI, which was tasked with protecting the country against cybercrime, was one of the last government agencies to hear about it, not until 11 a.m. In May 2000, the FBI fought cybercrime through the National Infrastructure Protection Center, an intradepartmental agency founded in 1998. It wouldn't have a dedicated cyber division until 2002. At the NIPC, Deputy Assistant Frank Vattis ordered a warning about I Love You to be sent to all government agencies. But by that point, many agencies had already been hit, and they couldn't even open their emails to read it anyway. FBI analysts raced against time to study I Love You and determine who created it. With the story all over the news, they had to act fast before the culprit could get rid of the evidence. I Love You wasn't particularly a complicated or even well-made worm. Hidden within the worm's code were two email addresses, both from the Philippines, spider@super.net.ph and mailme@super.net.ph. The code also contained a reference to Grammarsoft. They narrowed down their location, Manila. The FBI began coordinating with the Philippines National Bureau of Investigation and the head of the Anti-Fraud and Computer Crimes Division, Alfred Meneses, took charge of the investigation. After speaking with different ISPs, they obtained the IP address where I Love You had originated. By this point, news that the FBI and NBI were looking for a hacker in Manila had become public knowledge. O'Neill, still unaware of the danger, received a call from his mother.
"Son, this hacker, could it be you?"
O'Neill felt his stomach tighten. Was his I Love You worm the same one causing all this havoc? If so, he'd definitely proven his thesis worked, a little too well.
"Mom, you have to help me. Go to my apartment and get rid of all the computer equipment."
"When will I see you?"
his mother asked. O'Neill didn't know. He had to go into hiding. After their phone call, O'Neill crashed with a friend from Grammarsoft. O'Neill's mother went to his apartment and removed all of O'Neill's computers and equipment. The NBI was right on her heels. A short time later, Alfred Meneses and a squad of NBI agents showed up at O'Neill's door. Nobody was home except for Renell Ramones, O'Neill's sister Irene's boyfriend. Renell had no idea what I Love You was. He was just a bank manager. The NBI took him into custody anyway. Then the NBI searched the apartment. They found no computers, but O'Neill's mother had overlooked a box containing floppy disks. One of the floppy disks contained a code that was nearly identical to I Love You. This code was supposedly written not by O'Neill, but by Michael Boone, another member of Grammarsoft. Was Boone the real author of I Love You? Was it O'Neill? Was it both of them? How many people were involved? Meneses and his team headed to the computer college for answers. School officials remembered O'Neill and told investigators about his rejected thesis. To the NBI, the thesis amounted to an admission of guilt. O'Neill had become the lead suspect. Soon, O'Neill's face and name were plastered all over the news. He couldn't leave his friends' apartments without feeling exposed. Now, with Renell in custody, O'Neill knew he only had one option: turn himself in. On May 11th, O'Neill de Guzman and his sister Irene entered a police station with their lawyer, Rolando Quimbo. The police station was crowded with dozens of reporters and photographers. O'Neill wore dark glasses like Neo's in The Matrix and covered his face with a towel. Quimbo had instructed him to pretend not to speak English for their press conference and to deliver his answers through him.
"Are you responsible for I Love You?" a reporter asked.
Quimbo handled this one. "That's one of the questions we would rather leave for the future." Another reporter raised their hand.
"Well, if you did create it, did you release it deliberately or was it accidental?"
O'Neill whispered to his lawyer. "Is it possible there was no intention on the part of whoever did it?" Quimbo said. "It may just be youthful exuberance." Another reporter spoke up.
"Were you stealing people's passwords in the first place?"
O'Neill whispered again. "The internet is supposed to be educational, so it should be free," Quimbo said, drawing a surprised laugh from the crowd. Later, while speaking with reporters, Quimbo reiterated that O'Neill hadn't meant to release I Love You and certainly hadn't meant to cause a worldwide computer worm pandemic. He was telling the NBI the same thing. The NBI wasn't moved. Alfred Meneses and his team realized their mistake in arresting Ronel Ramones and releasing him. they narrowed down their list of suspects to 4, including O'Neill, Michael Boone, and 2 other members of Grammarsoft. While they continued the search for O'Neill, they interviewed Boone and the other Grammarsoft members. All denied have anything to do with I Love You. That left O'Neill, who had gone into hiding. There was also his thesis to consider. Investigators analyzed it and concluded that the blueprint for O'Neill's email password sender trojan was identical to the I Love You worm. This was proof enough for the NBI that O'Neill was the one responsible for I Love You. Since O'Neill came forward, Menences thought that O'Neill's explanation had been evasive, an attempt to avoid responsibility for I Love You. The NBI wanted to punish him. But what law could they charge O'Neill de Guzman with breaking? As of May 2000, the Philippines had no laws governing cybercrime. So when O'Neill's colleague Dean told him that his thesis was illegal months earlier, the dean had been wrong. O'Neill's thesis technically wasn't against the law because no laws existed. But that would soon change. But not in time to prosecute O'Neill for I Love You. The NBI didn't have enough to arrest him, but they weren't giving up that easily. Investigators spent more than a month searching for something, anything they could charge O'Neill with. Eventually, the focus shifted to O'Neill's Grammarsoft activities. While interviewing Grammarsoft members, the NBI learned about all of O'Neill's extracurricular activities, Trojan horsing people in chat rooms for their internet passwords, and sometimes stealing their credit card information. They even knew about the porn. Because O'Neill had illegally obtained people's credit card information to sign up for porn sites, the NBI decided that O'Neill had committed credit card fraud. This really had nothing to do with I Love You, but it was the next best thing. On June 15, 2000, the NBI formally charged O'Neill de Guzman with violating the Access Devices Regulation Act, a law that governed the illegal use of passwords in credit card and bank transactions. O'Neill faced up to 20 years in prison. The case dragged on. The NBI had trouble locating the people O'Neill scammed in the chat rooms. Then, prosecutors at the Philippines Department of Justice determined that the Access Devices Regulation Act couldn't be applied to computer crimes. Since O'Neill had obtained the passwords online, he was exempt from prosecution. The NBI dropped all charges against him on August 21, 2000. O'Neill was free. The world would eventually move on from I Love You, but for O'Neill, that would prove to be difficult. He was about to learn what being the creator of I Love You would do to his reputation. Within 10 days, it's estimated that I Love You infected more than 55 million computers worldwide. I Love You is estimated to have caused up to $10 billion in damage. Mostly, this cost was indirect, in the form of lost business due to servers being taken offline, and then the cost of removing the virus. Then there were the files overwritten on millions of hard drives. Time had to be spent restoring them, if the files could be restored at all. At Microsoft, Steven Sinofsky and his team spent 2 months writing a patch to make Outlook more secure. Even so, more worms continued to hit Microsoft operating systems. 4 years later, the Sasser worm infected up to 1 million computers and caused billions in damages. In 2001, the district court judge in United States versus Microsoft ruled against Microsoft. The decision was overturned on appeal. Microsoft then made a settlement with the Justice Department in 2001, agreeing to play nice with other browsers. In the weeks after I Love You's release, U.S. Senate subcommittees investigated the government's response and determined that it was woefully inadequate. The FBI was slow to detect I Love You. Many government agencies were hit. Among the worst was the Department of Health and Human Services, which lost email access for 6 days. If a biological disaster had occurred, HHS would have been effectively unable to respond to it. In the Philippines, the government quickly closed the loophole that allowed O'Neill to avoid prosecution. In June of 2000, the Philippines passed the E-Commerce Act, a law that outlawed computer hacking as well as provided guidelines for online business. In the year after I Love You, O'Neill de Guzman tried to resume his studies at AMA Computer College, but it refused to have him back. a few companies came forward and offered him jobs for being the mastermind behind the I Love You worm. He turned them down to avoid being associated with it, which he later regretted. Unemployed, he spent his days working out, playing PlayStation, watching the Discovery Channel, and avoided the spotlight. As of 2020, O'Neill was working at a smartphone repair shop in suburban Manila. He still says he didn't intend for the worm to spread like it did, and he regrets the damage it caused. A reporter once asked O'Neill a question. Since O'Neill was considered a notorious hacker, which other hacker would he most like to meet? O'Neill went with Microsoft founder Bill Gates. The I Love You worm still ranks among the worst malware attacks in the history of the web. It also demonstrated that malware can infect computers on a truly global scale. Scammers began using malware to create email spam. Today, over half of all emails worldwide are spam. That's 320 billion emails daily. All that spam is responsible for 94% of the malware that's still circulating today. But I Love You wasn't some sophisticated software program that wriggled its way onto other people's hard drives. It never would have worked if it weren't for one factor that's definitely analog: human gullibility. When it comes to online security, sometimes the weakest link is ourselves. I'm Keith Korneluk, and you're listening to Modem Mischief. Thanks for listening to this bonus episode of Modem Mischief. Your support keeps this show, which is an independent production, in business, the lights on, and turning out these badass bonus episodes. And we're grateful as all hell for you. Modem Mischief is brought to you by Mad Dragon Productions and is created, produced, and hosted by me, Keith Korneluk. This episode is written and researched by Jim Rowley. Mixed and mastered by David Swope, a.k.a. Party Up Front, After Party in the Rear. The theme song You Are Digital is composed by Computer Bandit. For more information about the show, go to modemmischief.com. And don't forget to follow us on social media at Modem Mischief and slide into our DMs. Thanks for listening.